I'm delighted to welcome to the Radio Cafe Craig Barnes. He's an author, playwright, he's a poet, he's founder of the group We Are People Here, and he's host of Our Times radio program right here on KSFR on Saturday mornings at 9 o'clock. He will be giving a series of three lectures starting this Thursday, February 6th, at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore. The theme of the lectures is An Inquiry into Empire, Capitalism, and the Engines of Inequality. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's great to see you.
It's great to see you, too. And I'm so glad that this is happening, because it was going to happen a few weeks ago, and
That's right, then.
It was put off for a while, and now you're here. Now, the whole question of capitalism and empire and inequality, at the basis of these questions that you're asking are moral questions.
Yes.
And I don't think that capitalism ever really set itself up to be a moral system, but its proponents say that it's, well, it's the best there is.
The proponents say, well, the free market is self-regulating and it'll bring out the best in people.
Right.
There's a little ounce of truth in that if you cheat on your contracts and cheat on your deals, people aren't going to want to do business with you. So the market does promote reliability and encourages people to do what they say they're going to do. That far you can go. That far you can go with Adam Smith, 1776, and say, okay, the market does that. The problem is that the market has, that the corporate form, which is the engine of the free market, has no moral content. It has no moral requirement. By law, profit is its single measure of success. And it's, for a human, that's not the single measure of success. How we get along, how we treat each other, our integrity, how we promote the long term, all of those are terrifically important for us as humans. And those are moral questions. How do we take care of each other? What do we do about the massive inequality, 28% of New Mexicans living in poverty? What do we do about that? A corporation doesn't have a rule that says we got to address that. But the people do. We do. And so we've got an engine that's driving us over the cliff with climate change, driving us into greater and greater inequality, and at the same time is by law required to ignore climate change and poverty, etc.
Well, one of the things and one of the arguments that's made is that you've got capitalism, you've got a market system, and then you've got government, which regulates it. And I think where it goes wrong is when the two get too close.
Absolutely, yeah. That's happened hugely in the financial industry. It's very distressing, but the SEC and there's an outfit called the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. Those guys were supposed to enforce whistleblower regulations. Those guys, Dodd-Frank said, okay, we're going to strengthen whistleblowers. And they've done the opposite. They have penalized the whistleblowers. They have SEC's actually helped the whistleblowers get fired by telling J.P. Morgan, said, look, you got this guy that's saying this about you. What do you think? And they say, well, what we think is he ought to go. So that kind of thing's been happening. And it's a very insider culture. Wall Street takes care of its own, and it does not have it's most unfortunate because we've set up the SEC and we set up these other agencies in order to try to create insurance for investors, try to create stability, security, integrity, and they have become such an insider game that they're now not doing it.
And so you have a system where whatever you do to regulate it, there are people who are, the second regulation comes out, trying to find ways around it.
Absolutely. And they're there before the regulation comes out. So after Dodd-Frank was passed in 2009 or 10, as it was being passed, the Wall Street investment guys were avalanching information down to Congress to say, don't do this, don't do that.
Yeah, getting it written in the way that serves them in the first place.
That would serve them in the first place. And the situation that the country is in is that massive amounts of money influence the Congress and influence campaigns for Congress, influence and control the lobbying, and millions spent on lobbying on Dodd-Frank, for example. And there is no way you and I or anybody in Santa Fe has that kind of capacity to get to Washington, to stay in Washington, to prepare the briefs and arguments, so that we are outflanked totally. And we're in a situation in this country where there really is a plutocracy, a governing class that has that kind of money, that's a billionaire. We have representative government. We have representative for the government for the billionaires. And the rest of us are just having a heck of a time getting recognition, getting into the process. So that's where we are, and Wall Street is the engine at the center of it.
And so in your lectures, you take on some of the actual mechanisms and functions of Wall Street and how it works. How, for example, I mean, and I've seen this during my entire adult life, it seems like business school is teaching its students and then its graduates go out into the world to try to figure out ways to get money out of taxpayers and into corporate pockets. And
yes, good.
It's one thing to sell a product. I'm sitting here at a table covered with products like headphones and mixers and computers and mugs and things like that. And it's honest work. But there's a sort of meta and meta level of creating and then sucking up money that doesn't, it's not really based on things.
Absolutely. It's a great point, Mary Charlotte, that until 1998, banking was supposed to stay in banking, lending in order to promote creativity and industry and the production of real things. After 1998 and the repeal of Glass-Steagall, Wall Street has gotten into the financial game of hedge funds and derivatives and things, and that's a huge casino.
Now, do you want to just tell people a little bit what Glass-Steagall is or was so
sure.
that we can talk about the before and after?
Glass-Steagall was a 1930s regulation on banking when banking was in such terrible shape and viewed strongly by the public. Glass-Steagall said that banks can do banking. They can lend, but they can't do investment. They can't buy up copper mines. They can't buy up Greece. They can't buy up this and become players in that game. Banks are to be lenders.
So banks, basically the place where you and I go and have our checking account and savings account and that stuff.
Yes. And so, yeah, right across the street here is Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo was until the end of that regime in 1998, Wells Fargo was supposed to be lending money. Now it takes our deposits and uses them as the foundation for its own investments in Ecuador, copper, or wherever, in the developing world. They're in the game of investment. And they're not only engaged in the specific things that produce things, like you say, production is something. Making money off of money is something different. Making money off of money for 1,000 years under the Catholic Church was supposed to be horrible. You're not supposed to do that. Islam still says making money off of money is immoral. But now we say making money off of money is a trillion-trillion-dollar game. It's a $70 trillion game. And it doesn't produce a hammer or a nail or an airplane or a bridge or anything.
So when I put my money in a national bank, whether it be Wells Fargo or any of these other banks, inadvertently, I'm essentially playing the market.
You are affording them leverage. If you put in $100, they can lend out or spend 10 times that. It gives them the available resources to go 10 times that amount into the market or into the derivatives game. So your resources, your deposits, are actually theirs.
And they're gambling with them.
And they're gambling with them, exactly right. And they did that, of course, before 2008 when they collapsed. And now we discover that the rules are that your deposits don't actually belong to you. They belong to the bank. So Citigroup or J.P. Morgan Chase or Wells Fargo got your deposit. If they are in trouble because they've spent too much on derivatives and credit default swaps and whatever other kind of instrument they buy, if they get in trouble, your money is theirs to try to get out of trouble.
But, I mean, I can still, let's say I've got $2,000 in the bank, I can still go to the bank and withdraw it. Is that not true?
Unless they are required by the international banking community to use that money to pay off their debts to other banks, which is the case that happened in Cyprus. When Cyprus depositors said, wait a minute, I want my 1,000 drachmas or whatever, euros, I guess, well, the Bank of Settlements, the network, this core group at the center in Basel, Switzerland, said, sorry, depositors, that money belongs to Goldman Sachs. And they lost their deposit. So we've always thought that our deposits belong to us, of course. We put the money in, we should give. In fact, the way this system is structured now, even that's insecure.
Now, is that true in the United States? Aren't we insured?
We're insured, but the insurance runs up to some, I can't remember what the FDIC total amount is, but they have nothing like insurance resources compared to the indebtedness in this in this derivatives market. So just imagine this, that the derivatives market is estimated to be somewhere around 70 trillion. There is not enough GDP on the planet to pay those 70 trillion in debts.
Right.
So if another Lehman Brothers comes along and fails, and it can't pay its debts, then it draws on Goldman Sachs, and it can't pay its debts, the House of Cards is in danger of collapsing.
And I think what is hard to get your head around is that inevitably, sooner or later, it all is going to collapse, maybe within our lifetimes or maybe not, but sooner or later we will return to nature, which is the only reality.
It's a great point. And historically speaking, these collapses have occurred every 30 or 40 years in U.S. history. 1809, 1817, 1837, 1873, 1893, 1933. All of those were panics like the one we had in 2008. Debt is the single most consistent cause of revolt in human history. People say not being able to pay their debts and having this collision that we're staring in the face now between debtors and creditors. So for 5,000 years, the issue of what the creditor gets to take from us and how much these vacuum cleaners of sucking up our money, how much they can take before it all collapses, that's the issue.
When you say it's the single biggest cause of revolt, what do those revolts look like?
They've been, you know, we're talking all the way back to Greek times and Roman times. Spartacus is one kind of Roman history. But in 1383, the peasants who were being foreclosed on, losing their land, marched on London. They picked up their pitchforks and marched on London. They said, kill all the lawyers, burn all the records. They dragged the Lord Chief Justice out of his house in London and hung him. So they've been pretty brutal sometimes. France has had its upheavals in the 14th century as well. And here in this country, we got into things like the Haymarket riots in the 1880s in Chicago. And ultimately, the unrest starts with the people who are desperate. Nobody wants to go to the streets. Nobody wants to be seen and shouting. But if you're hungry, and that's what they've often come down to, hunger, then that's when they explode.
We're talking to Craig Barnes about his lecture series, An Inquiry into Empire, Capitalism, and the Engines of Inequality. I think one of the things that is interesting is that no matter how many revolts there are, no matter how many people they string up and pitchforks and everything else, the system always reforms and returns.
It's a great point. This struggle between the very wealthy and the masses of the population is probably permanent. And every now and then, people break through and we get a reform in a constitution, or we get the American Revolution, which in its first stages was a debtors' revolution. And of course, the Boston Tea Party, those are debtors' revolutions. But every time, here's the ironic twist. As the people succeed and create democratic institutions, democratic institutions are great for promoting wealth. The broader the initiative, the broader the participation, the greater the wealth, the more success a culture has, and that's been the American experience. But there are those always who want to harvest that wealth for themselves and forget that they got it through democracy, through the rule of law, through integrity, through values, through moral virtue. They forget that's also the source of their wealth, and they try to box it in. They try to bring it inside the moat, inside the castle. That's what was happening in 1929, and that's what's happening today.
And it's very tricky, because when I look at people who are hoarding wealth in really extreme ways, millionaires, billionaires, this kind of like, and you think to yourself, what more do they want to buy that they don't already have? And then I look at my own life, which by maybe American standards is somewhat modest, and by third world standards is luxurious beyond belief. And I think, well, maybe I'm doing the same thing.
There is a necessity to be able to participate in your own culture. And if you're a player, if you have, as you are here in Santa Fe and on radio, if you're a player, you have enough. you could have some more, but you have enough. And the issue is, in any culture, whether it's Kenya or Nepal or whether it's Santa Fe, the issue is, are the doors open? Have you got a chance to participate and get in? And the greater the gap, the greater the wealth gap. And in the United States today, it's greater than it's been at least since 1929. The harder it is to get in, as harder it is to figure it away from Capitol High School to the east side. What are the stepping stones that get you from Capitol High School to the east side mansions? You can't see them. They're not evident how you do that. And the greater that gap, and the longer that road, and the less likely it appears that anybody can travel it, the more the despair, the more the... What happens in cultures of great inequality is that the poor don't start out picking on the rich. They pick on each other. So the crime that goes on takes its toll first with the people who are in poverty. They're the ones that suffer the first. And so we are destroying the elements of civility, mutual respect, dignity, by this inequality. And the engine that drives that inequality is the interest engine of banks. Maybe that needs a word. But notice this, Mary Charlotte. Money is all created by bank loans. It's not created by, there's a little bit of current coinage that's created by the federal government. 97% of all the money comes when you go to get a house loan. And they just write $100,000 into your account or $50,000, whatever it is, and that money's in the economy. You can go spend it. Money is created by banks. That's the system. That's the capital system. What we don't know and don't understand is they never create enough. They give you $100,000, give your business here for the rail yard or wherever in Santa Fe, $100,000. They don't give you enough to pay back the interest. So interest requirements are always in excess of the money in circulation. What does that do? It creates requirements for student loans, for house loans, for car loans, for business loans, always more than there is money out there. And who is getting that money? The banks. Who's beginning to reap the excess profits? It's the banks. So, and it's not local banks. It's the big banks. It's the global banks. Local banks do a great service. The distinction needs to be made. But the global banks are the vacuum cleaners that have their hands into our credit card debt, or their suckers into our credit card debt or student debt, whatever it is.
And then what do they do with that money?
They are doing two things primarily. One, they are creating new instruments that are unregulated, of financial instruments, and betting against each other in the casino on Wall Street. And they're betting that they're going to figure out what's going to fail and what's going to succeed. So it's a casino. The other thing they're doing with it is investing in our resources. So I have seen articles, and I haven't been able to verify these, because you really need two or three sources before you can say this is, I think this is certainly true, but I've seen articles that say that Wells Fargo and JP Morgan Chase, etc., are buying up the copper, buying up the cotton, buying up the farmland, buying up the resources. And I have seen, legitimately, I've seen memos from the American Banking Association in the 1890s saying to the bankers in the Banking Association, this depression will help us. Don't stop the foreclosure cycles, because we can move in and buy up this land at bargain basement prices in foreclosure. So the response to that, one response, you didn't ask me for what a response is, but one response is public banking. Let's create banks where the loans and the benefits of those loans go back into the public coffers. It's a great idea. It's been around, and now it's coming to the fore. So we're going to be working on that.
Very interesting. We are talking to Craig Barnes about his upcoming lecture series, An Inquiry into Empire, Capital, and the Engines of Inequality. The fact that banks are talking about farmland, houses, copper mines, and so on does get back to the reality that at the root of all economies, no matter how much derivatives and layers of meta money you put on top of the basics, economies are based in nature. They're based on real things: land, food, water, minerals, and things like that. And we're at a time that's completely unprecedented in the history of civilization, which is that we're ruining those very things. to the point where we cannot sustain the civilization that sustains the economic system.
Yes.
And nobody's dealing with that. Everyone's talking about it, but no one's dealing with it.
That's absolutely right. In the second lecture that I'll do on the 20th of February, I want to talk about the short-term, the amorality of a corporation by definition. It is by definition required to promote success in the short term and ignore the long term. And as you say, in the long term, we're driving us over a cliff. We're losing our sustainable resources. We're creating water that can't sustain fish. We are drying up New Mexico in this climate change situation. And it can't be sustained. And there's nothing within the corporate structure or the traditional capitalist structure that says, wait a minute, we have to preserve the long term. So by definition, we are being driven by a system and a philosophy which is self-defeating and ultimately suicidal.
Very much so. And yet moral systems, I mean, we talk about amorality, but when you've got moral systems and you try to enforce them, it's really just a few steps from a good idea to the Inquisition.
Yes. Well, we may be in some danger of that. We're not in the same situation that they are in the Ukraine, or they are in Moscow, or they are in China. So we're still got some things going for us in terms of what we can talk about and say. And I think we have a tradition here that is extraordinarily valuable in this country. We have a tradition of people saying, you can't do that to me. There is a kind of a don't tread on me tradition that I witnessed one time in Moscow. When I was working over there, I witnessed a guy get arrested, and the police walked up to him and said, took him off, and off he went. Just, okay, you got me. KGB got him. 2 weeks before that, I had witnessed an arrest in Washington, D.C. pharmacy. And they got him around, they caught him taking the money out of the till. I watched it myself. He took the money out of there. Wow, they grabbed him. And they chased him down the street and dragged him back through the pharmacy on his back, him shouting, you can't do this to me. You can't do this to me. I'm an American. You can't do this to me. And that spirit runs wall to wall in our culture. So I think that's why we're going to stand up to this.
It's interesting because if we have a tradition which is a human rights, individual rights tradition, a legal tradition of free speech and so on, then you can only really oppress the people and bend them to your will if you control their minds in some way through belief systems, propaganda, and lack of critical thinking, things like that.
Yes, and what we have going for us here is the gradual recognition that the story of American success got hijacked in the 1980s. It got hijacked at first by Ayn Rand, and she was so successful telling a story of me first, me in all ways, my greed above your greed. That became a cultural norm for the think tanks, and the Cato Institute and the Heritage Fund, places that the Koch brothers subsidized. That story, with Ronald Reagan as the actor to personify it and give it, it looked like heart, that story has taken over the American dialogue. When Ronald Reagan says, I'm here, the most dangerous words in the English language are, I'm here from the government and I'm here to help. And ever since, government has been painted into a corner. That's turning around. The Health Care Act is going to be enormous in that effect that it's turning around. And it's turning around because people are gradually beginning to see that the Tea Party solution is not a solution. It's a furious outrage against the same thing, actually, as the radical left is against, this concentration of wealth and power in the hands far beyond their control. So ultimately, this story that greed is good, for God's sake, and Margaret Thatcher said, there is no such thing as society. For God's sake, we are genetically programmed to take care of each other. We're genetically programmed to help each other with breakfast. We're genetically programmed for some of us to drive on one side of the street and the other. We are a cooperative species. Yeah. And it's not just you and me saying that. That's the result of now some stunning research, biological research, evolutionary biology research, game theory research. We have the program in us to find the ones who will work with us and to walk on down the street past the ones who are just going to throw stones at us.
Well, we have that program. I mean, I don't think it's an either or. We're cooperative or we're competitive. We're clearly a lot of both. I mean, chimpanzee societies have thugs and gangs and all kinds of horrible stuff that looks just like what we do.
We absolutely have it, but we've gotten where we've gotten by our ability to civilize it, through our ability to... The rule of law is an extraordinary imposition of the last 1,100 years. Extraordinary. But that's one of those steps that helps us corral or contain our violence.
And I think there's another piece to that which is important to talk about, which is when the rule of law begins to apply to men and women equally, and you have men and women taking their part in government equally, there's another kind of civilizing that is just inherently less violent because women tend to be, you know, a few exceptions on both sides, whatever, but tend to be less violent. And I think that there's a lot of hope there.
Absolutely. And it's a great point. And you know, I wrote a book about the evolution of women's history in search of the lost feminine. And the last time, my conclusion after looking at 3,500 years is that the last 150 years have unleashed women into the conversation, into the marketplace, into research, into training, into education, in ways that from which this culture, this global culture, will never be the same. We are experiencing the first part of that. When I went to law school, there were two women in my law school. Now the majority of women in law school, the majority of doctors are women. The majority of people in law schools are women. I think that this is going to have, as you say, I'm just agreeing with you, long-term substantial impacts.
You know where we're not? We're not anywhere like a majority or even half on Wall Street or in the military-industrial complex or in the real engines of inequality, capitalism, and empire. We're not there, women.
That's right. There's a long way to go, and it's still true that women make 77% of what men make for the same work. It's not that we're there, but that it seems to me that we've passed the tipping point. There's not going to be a way to close the door on what we've accomplished in these last few years. And, you know, I tried a lawsuit on behalf of women in the 1970s, and the judge said, well, it was a wage case, women get paid less because they have babies. End of story. Well, thanks very much.
Where's the logic in that?
That wouldn't hold up today.
You know, that's like saying, I killed that dog because the sky is blue.
Yeah, it's not connected.
It's not connected.
But that was the misogyny, which was the governing understanding in most of white male culture. It still is. I mean, when Hillary Clinton saddles up and gets ready for this next race, if she does that, and I'm sure she will, the misogyny is going to come pouring out. We're going to see that again in equal amount to the racism that we've seen in the last 6 years. But I think she might be able to pull it off. And, you know, my first choice is Elizabeth Warren. I think there's a progressive for
president.
For president, you bet, absolutely. She understands this financial industry, and she's not in bed with it. And I'm a little nervous about Hillary on that score. But I'll take her against any Republican anywhere.
Well, I mean, I think this gets back to what we were talking about in the beginning, which is the extreme connection between government and the forces of capitalism, which really should be separate if they're both going to work properly. Government should regulate without capitalism telling it how to do so. And I can't even imagine a system where that actually happens. Maybe it does happen in Scandinavia or whatever, but
it has happened here to greater or lesser degree at different times. So Teddy Roosevelt comes after and becomes a trust buster, and FDR becomes a radical in redistribution of wealth and the attack on the financial industry. It has happened. It's just and actually that held for probably 50 years. That revolution in banking and in control and working on behalf of the whole population all the way through the war on poverty under Lyndon Johnson, that held. But with Ronald Reagan and the massive influence of billionaire money now, we're currently losing that battle, but I think we're gonna win it.
Craig Barnes is an author, playwright, poet, He's founder of the group We Are People Here. He's host of Our Times on KSFR on Saturday mornings at 9 o'clock. And this Thursday, February 6th, is the first of a series of three lectures called An Inquiry into Empire, Capitalism, and the Engines of Inequality. The next lectures are also on Thursdays at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore, February 20th and 27th. And I want to ask you, tell us just a little bit before we go about the group We Are People Here.
We Are People. I gave some lectures at the Collected Works 3 years ago in 2011. And there was this thing, when you're talking about history of the public revolt, you begin to see a pattern. And I was struck 40 years ago by reading the comment of a revolutionary in Spain in 1896 who was saying to the Spanish Empire, you know, we may have dark skins and we may look like we live in the jungle, but we are by God people here. And that struck me. I mean, all that years ago stuck in my mind. And after the end of those lectures in 2011, it turns out, when you think about it, that's what women have been saying. We're people here. That's what Sojourner Truth said. I'm a woman and I'm a person here. That's what the blacks were saying in the 1960s. Wait a minute. We should have equal chance in court. We should have equal chance in the economy. We're people here. Clearly that's a cry that runs down through history. And it runs on behalf of everybody now. And the middle class has got to say that, because the other side is calling them all takers. Wait a minute. We're not takers. We're people here. We have a
right
putting,
to... We're taking out what we put in.
Yes, I mean, call them entitlements. Some money I earned. Yeah. I put that money in there. That's not a taker. That's a participant. And so that's the organization We Are People Here has been capitalizing on that sentiment and working in banking. We've been working in alternative currencies. We've been working on just elevating the understanding globally, not globally, but statewide and also around the country, of the plutocracy and the idea that plutocracy and democracy both describe forms of government, and they are mutually exclusive. And democracy is in danger, and we're going to do what we can to preserve it.
Craig Barnes, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's great to see you.